Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 129 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her sleep. Yeah, this is really going to be interesting. Before we hop into this episode, just know it's made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix customized for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, go to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode and rate and review our podcast, because I'm sitting here waiting to hear from you. That's right. I read these things. Love it, love it, love it. Okay, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Listen, if you don't have this one book, you better run out and just get it right now, because sleep is where it's at. And sticking with your daily natural body rhythms is bottom line for you, especially as you start the new year. The title of the book is The Power of When. And this is written by Dr. Michael Bruce, who is a clinical psychologist and both a diplomat of the American Board of Sleep Medicine and a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. I'm telling you right now, he is the guru in this sector. This is why we always have Dr. Bruce back on. I'm telling you that sleep is such a powerful new topic. It's everywhere. I don't care what you're reading out there, what you're reviewing online. If you haven't gotten the message that getting enough and high quality sleep is important, then I don't know where you've been. Dr. Bruce, welcome back to the Her podcast.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy this.
Now,
podcast.
We were just talking a minute ago about the fact that very recently, the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine was just awarded to three American scientists, Drs. Jeffrey Hall, Michael Rosbach, and Michael Young. And they were named Nobel laureates for their circadian rhythm discoveries that explain how plants, animals, and humans adapt their biological rhythm so that it's synchronized with the Earth's revolutions, and oh boy, does that have an effect on health. Well, listen, Michael, you and I both clicked our heels with happiness as we jumped for joy when we saw that the Nobel Prize was finally given to someone who really did. I mean, they have 30 years of superb work under their belts with identifying the genes associated with circadian rhythm, and then why this is so terribly important. And this falls right into your wonderful work in chronobiology. So tell us why you were so excited about this and how this fits into your message.
Well, to be honest with you, you know, first of all, when I found out about the announcement, I was thrilled because, first of all, it really sheds light on the importance of sleep, right? So we know that basically there are two systems in the body for sleep. One is a drive for sleep, and the other is a rhythm for sleep. It's a little bit like hunger, right? So I'm hungry. I eat something, and then that hunger begins to dissipate. That is the drive for sleep. There's some neurochemical reasons why that happens, but just trust me on this one. It's a buildup of something called adenosine. And as you get more of that in your head, you get sleepier and sleepier and sleepier. But that's not the only system. It turns out that there's a second system called your circadian rhythm. And this is a system that basically, a lot like hunger, you ever notice how you only get hungry around breakfast or around lunchtime or around dinner time? The same holds true with sleep, as most people get sleepy on a particular circadian rhythm. And I was super excited because, let's be honest, I just published a book within the last year all about circadian rhythms, and the Nobel Prize for circadian came out in medicine about circadian rhythms. So I felt a little vindicated. that my work was a little bit ahead of the time. I'm not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that I deserve a Nobel Prize. But what I am saying is it was really kind of nice to see that science and medicine is really taking circadian and chronobiology seriously. The actual discovery was complicated, but the basics of it were they were looking at fruit flies. And by the way, we look at fruit flies for circadian rhythm all the time. That's actually a very good model within the medical literature. And what they discovered is that there's a special gene that encodes a protein, and that protein accumulates in our cells during the night, and then it kind of degrades during the day. And they found that there's actually a rhythm to that. And that was kind of the basics of their discovery. After that, they identified additional proteins and actually were able to figure out the mechanism of how does a cell figure out when is it supposed to take on proteins and when is it supposed to get off those proteins. And that's really the fundamental aspect of the what they discovered, which was really pretty cool, if you ask me. I mean, I was pretty excited about it, and it has a lot to do with what I was talking about in my book, The Power of When.
Well, you know, when I read The Power of When, which I just absolutely love, right, one of the things that is the biggest challenge is, you know, like our HER listeners right now for the podcast are sitting back saying, but, you know, do I really need that much sleep? I've got so much to do. I'm living a 24/7 existence. I'm running around like a nutcase. The one thing, the one place I can find some, and I quote, wiggle room is by just cutting into sleep. And why can't I just make up for it on the weekend? And you're annoying, Dr. Bruce, and let me just live my life.
You're not the first person to say that. I've actually had.
So, what do you say to him?
I know. I had one patient call me Dr. Evil one time because he said I took all the fun out of it. Here's the truth. Sleep is a lot like a baseball game. Okay? If the game starts at 8 o'clock and you show up at 9:30, they don't start the game over for you, right? You're stuck in the third inning. The same holds true as if you show up too early in the game. You're going to get to see batting practice, but you're not going to actually get to see the game. Our circadian rhythm, our internal biological clock, has a timing to it. And if the closer we can get to our biological timing, the better our biology will be in sync with our emotions, be in sync with literally everything that we do. So when patients say to me, Dr. Bruce, I'm going to stay up late, or you know, I'm going to skimp on sleep during the week and then make it up on the weekend. Here's the thing is when the game is over, the game is over. If you sleep in, let's say you normally wake up at 6:30 and you sleep in until 8 o'clock on the weekend, you know, when the baseball game is over and the ninth inning is done, unless there's extra inning, which there usually is not, you're just sitting in the stands by yourself. You're not going to get the same kind of sleep. You will sleep, but you're not going to get the type of sleep that you're actually missing by sleeping late. And, in fact, you can shift that whole circadian rhythm. So what could basically happen in our analogy is because all the fans decided on Saturday night to stay for extra innings, even though there weren't any, then they're just going to move the start time of the game. And that's literally what happens to your biology, is if you sleep in more than 30 minutes, your entire internal biological clock actually shifts, almost like you were in an airplane and flying to a new time zone. And, of course, it takes your body a full evening or two to get past that shift. So once you sleep in on Saturday and then again on Sunday, come Monday, I give you one guess what your body wants to do. And by the way, if not, get up.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, it's just the hardest thing, right? There are so many challenges out there. You have the people who make the to-do list from hell, which has 95 items, and they obsessively have to finish that before they go to bed, all right? So that makes it about 2 in the morning, right, if they're lucky.
Right.
They, you know, hop up and they have all those fun things like caffeine and caffeine and caffeine to try to power them through the day and just keep moving it along. And after a while, they've sort of set up a sort of a faux rhythm, body rhythm. They think that's supposed to be their body. Isn't that right?
Yeah, no, it's exactly what people do. And it's so unfortunate because they're trying to force their body into a rhythm that their body doesn't want to get into. And that's kind of what we talk about in the book, is there are four very distinct rhythms. Now, you know, I've been talking about chronorhythms, and there might be some folks out there who are listening who didn't hear our previous podcast about it. So let me just tell people really quickly. A chronorhythm it's not this big fancy word. And you've all actually heard of chronorhythms before. If you've ever been told that you're an early bird or a night owl, those are chronorhythms. So just so that everybody is keenly aware, is everybody's heard of these chronorhythms. It turns out there aren't two, there's actually four. So early birds, I call these people lions. And the reason I call them, I switched from birds to mammals was because, well, I'm a mammal. And I felt like I could identify more with them. Lions are my my COOs. These are my wake up at 4:30, 5 o'clock. They're shooting emails out by 6. They've already gone for a 5K run. And they have a tendency to be very type A, almost militant. They can, start a list at the beginning of the day, and they'll go from step 1 to step 2 to step 3 right down their list. But the problem with being a lion, and believe it or not, there are problems with being a lion, is socially. Lions cannot do dinner in a movie because they're so doggone exhausted. I mean, they've been up since 4:30 in the morning, for gosh sake. So it's not, while it may be productive to be a lion, in many cases, it's not socially productive, only financially or work-related productive. The next chronotype are what I call a bear, and these are the people that are in between the early birds and the night owl. Now, the reason that being a bear is so good is because all of society is built on a bear's schedule. Most people don't realize this, but in fact, our entire 9-to-5 work schedule is all based around a bear. Bears have a tendency to wake up around 7:30. They have a tendency to go to bed around 10:30. These are my extroverts, usually, not all the time, but usually. These are the people that have a real tendency to get work done. They're gregarious. They're fun. They like to go out to lunch. They might invite people over for dinner. They might be the ones who are buying drinks at the bar, that kind of person. And I think bears are the best. They represent almost 50 to 55% of the population. The next one are the night owls, and I call them wolves. Now, I will tell you, I am a wolf. I am a night owl. I rarely, if ever, go to bed before midnight. It's just not in my nature to do so. And it never has been, by the way. Since I was a young boy, since I was 13 or 14 years old, I did not go to bed early. And I kept that. And there are some people out there who are similar to me as well. We have a tendency to be a little bit more introverted. We also have a tendency to be very creative people. My wolves are my actors and my authors, my athletes sometimes, although athletes also have a tendency to be lions. But very creative people. And if you're a wolf and you make a list at the beginning of the day, you never follow it. You're lucky if you get 3 items on it checked off, and they certainly wouldn't be 3 in a row.
Yeah.
You know, we are just a different breed of people. And then there are my dolphins. And my dolphins are my problem children. They're my troubled sleepers, usually. They're very similar to lions. They are type A personalities. They get a lot of stuff done. But they have very fragmented and broken sleep. Oftentimes, they're self-diagnosed as insomniacs. And they will talk about themselves as having insomnia on a very regular basis. They are very keen to hopefully get a better night's rest, and will try just about anything to do so.
Interesting. So questions. So
yes.
Number one, as you age, do you change from category to category?
Question. So I think I might be in the midst of starting to change. So I will be 50 this year. And that's really what
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Well, actually, in 2018 in February. So I'm aging myself a little bit, but, you know, what are you going to do? So
hey,
one of the things we know is that right around age 50, many people's melatonin production begins to slow down. And that makes it so that they have a tendency to not be such a night person, but more of a mid person or a morning person. But historically, what we have a tendency to see is around age 50 or 55, people will either become a lion or a dolphin. So we know that the lion has to do with this change in melatonin production, but the dolphin is a little bit different. People, when they hit the 50, 55 age mark and they become more of a dolphin or a problem sleeper, it's usually due to some type of medical situation or medication that they're taking that could be having an effect on their sleep. So absolutely, people do change. And in the reverse direction as well, we see that when we look at children, children actually have several years where they participate in all three of the primary chronotypes, being a lion, a bear, and a wolf.
Oh, how fascinating. And so what do they do? Like flip a coin and end up being one or the other? I mean, how's that work? Is that genetic? Is there genetics here with the sleep?
Yeah. It turns out that there is. So a while back, a group of scientists discovered something called the period gene, and specifically the period three. Period one, period two, and period three all have to do with sleep, sleep drive, as well as sleep timing. And so this is all actually genetically predetermined. Believe it or not, you could go to 23andMe and pull up your data, and they now have a morningness and eveningness report that they give people.
They do not. Oh, seriously?
I swear to you.
That's fascinating.
I swear to you. It came out right after my book, of course. But I feel like Nostradamus, right?
I know, really. What else do you have planned? I'm going to start planning around you.
I'm looking at all kinds of cool projects these days, I'll tell you that. It is fascinating, but you will see that happen quite a bit.
I love that. Well, you know, I'm thinking about myself, right? So
yep.
I think that I have always had lion tendencies. So, And I think it also is somewhat influenced by the fact that I'm also an athlete. And so, you know, so many of us get up early and just sort of knock it
out,
right?
Absolutely.
And I've done that for years. And but I found that I was kind of nudged a little closer to my lioness activities when I actually began a lot of my work at the National Institutes of Health, because in order to get onto the equipment in my laboratory when I wanted to, I had to beat everyone else out to it. So in order to do that, I had to be in my lab by about 7:15 in the morning, and hello, lion hours. But they felt comfortable to me. And it was okay.
Good.
And I like that. But, you know, the other thing, too, is that authors don't just write in the evening. I have done a lot of that in the past. However, John Grisham and some of the other guys like myself right now, we like to write first thing in the morning when our neurons are starting to connect. And so creativity can also happen in those lion hours, too, I believe. I feel myself beginning to move and become a teeny bit more bearish. All right.
So
I'm wondering
so
whether or
good.
Not I'm. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. It does. So first of all, I want to make a quick comment about writers and authors and things like that. So it's fascinating. One of the things, and I've worked with several famous authors before, one of the things that's interesting is they're creative right after they wake up, but they cannot edit at that point in time.
So oh, that's a really good point. Neither can I. That's why God made editors. Seriously, you're absolutely right. I could just splay it out there. I mean, those pages are just flipping right and left, but I have to come back to it later on.
Right. And so what's interesting is that that creative brainstorming, if you will, happens very early in the morning. And there's actually a very important reason for that. So we know in our sleep cycle, at the very end of our sleep cycle, is where we have the largest amount of REM sleep. REM sleep is where we move information from our short-term memory to our long-term memory, and we lock it in. So when we want to retrieve information that we learned the previous day, week, month, what have you, we've got to have had REM sleep, which will lock in that information. It basically creates kind of an organizational substructure in our brain for making information easy to retrieve. So why am I giving this whole big, long backstory? Because right after you wake up in the morning, it's the easiest time for your brain to retrieve information. And that's what brainstorming is. That's what creativity is. It's taking different pieces of information and putting them together in a unique way that nobody's ever seen or you've never seen before. And so this is one of the reasons why we're also creative in the morning. So for folks out there who are listening, if you've got a creativity project that you've been working on, one of the best things to do is to try to work on it early because that can be very, very helpful. And then if you want to get to the fine details of it, then you actually want to go later in the either the early evening or in the early or the late morning. So like around 10:30, 11 o'clock before lunch is a great time to zoom in and focus. And then again at about 4:30, depending on who you are, is another good time to focus.
I've got a really interesting challenge for you. And that challenge is the people and the growing number of people with sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
And
Oh, yeah.
How that affects circadian rhythm, how that affects quality of sleep, let alone quantity. What goes on with that? Because I have so many patients with this issue, and they're really concerned about what this is doing to them. And they're doing the best they can. They're on CPAP, BiPAP, and, you know, all the rest of it. Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. So here's what we can. Here's what we know about the kind of the state of the science, if you will, for sleep apnea. So, and for folks out there who may not remember what sleep apnea is where your throat basically closes in the middle of the night and you cannot breathe. That's called obstructive sleep apnea. There's also one called central sleep apnea. That's where your brain tells your lungs don't breathe, but that's a much more rare case, a very different treatment path that you would go on. But for obstructive sleep apnea, again, the most popular kind, there's an obstruction or a blockage in the throat that prevents you from breathing. Well, that's not good. Generally speaking, we like our patients to breathe, right? You like your patients to breathe, don't you, Dr. Pam?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. So we want them to breathe, especially when they're sleeping. So here's what ends up happening is there's a blockage. They relax when they go to bed. The muscles get more and more relaxed, 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 and then boom, we have a cutoff of air. And then the heart rate slows down. And the reason your heart rate slows down is it's trying to conserve oxygen in the system. Then your brain gets into the act after about 30 to 45 seconds and says, holy crap, there's no air in here. We need to wake up and breathe. And then your heart rate will speed up in order to wake you up to breathe. So that's where this scenario comes out where somebody's breathing, they stop breathing, and all of a sudden they have a gasp for air or they begin choking for air. Now, why am I going into all this detail? When we look at the long-term effects of undiagnosed or untreated sleep apnea, the cardiac effects are humongous. So here's what happens. Is in many cases, we get what's called a Brady tachycardia. And, of course, you know what that
right.
is, Dr. Pam, but for folks out there, that's where we have a super-duper slowdown and then a super-duper speed-up of the heart. This puts an extra load on the heart. And, you know, one of the things that we love when our muscles get big and strong, but one of the things that we don't like is when our heart muscles get too big because that can actually cause an irregular heartbeat. And there's a lot of data now to show that hypertension that does not react to medication could actually be a consequence of undiagnosed sleep apnea. We also know that general high blood pressure is affected by sleep apnea. The list goes on and on. We've got atrial fibrillation that people get over the course of time when they have undiagnosed sleep apnea. So number one, the cardiac effects are significant. Number two is the weight gain. One of the things that we've seen, and the research is very consistent on this, actually my second book was called The Sleep Doctor's Diet, Lose Weight Through Better Sleep, was all about this. Is people who have sleep apnea are not getting good quality sleep, not just the quantity issue, which is the waking up multiple times a night. And by the way, people can wake up anywhere from five times an hour to hundreds, that's plural, hundreds of times an hour. So you can only imagine how disoriented they are, you know, when they get up. But because of this, we know that their hormones are off. And when their hormones are off, it makes them eat at times that they shouldn't be eating, and it slows down their metabolism, and it causes weight gain. So undiagnosed sleep apnea, number one, if it doesn't kill you from a cardiac perspective, you're going to become obese, diabetic, and die from something that has to do with that. So it's just generally speaking, it's not good to not treat your sleep apnea.
All right, so let's just say we've treated it. We got the CPAP, BiPAP, whatever we're going to be using, and those are the specialized, masks for her audience out there. Some just involves almost like a nasal cannula. That's the BiPAP, and others actually have a mask covering both nose and mouth, et cetera, and hooked up to a special device that alternates pressure to be able to keep opening up that airway that Dr. Bruce described as sort of clamping down. Now, let's just say you're treated. You're treated appropriately. You have a great sleep doctor. We're good to go. What now is the issue? Is there an issue? Are you okay? Are you good to go? What else should someone with treated sleep apnea be thinking about?
So first of all, people who have treated sleep apnea, that's awesome. We're so excited because the more people that are treated, the fewer sleepy drivers that are on the road, the fewer sleepy accidents that occur. So we're all big fans of that. Once you're treated, there's a couple things that can happen. So one thing that happens with several of my patients is once they get on a CPAP machine or have an oral appliance, which is a different kind of treatment for sleep apnea, they begin to lose weight. And that's fantastic because then we can start to get their diabetes under control. We can get their weight under control. So that's a good thing that happens. Many of my patients, it's interesting, if they lose enough weight, sometimes they get off the breathing machine called the CPAP, and then they don't even have to have treatment anymore. So that's something that's pretty amazing that I've seen happen. But again, this is all predicated on the idea that you continue to use the treatment, which is the CPAP. Unfortunately, there is a 50% compliance rate, meaning only 50% of people actually use the CPAP machine. The other 50% use it as a doorstop. So we really have to, you know, tell people, look, if you or a loved one has sleep apnea, use your CPAP machine or whatever your treatment path is, because it's definitely going to be better for you in the long run. And yes, I've got patients who they travel with their CPAPs, they bring it on vacation, they go everywhere with them, and it really is a lifesaver. So the long-winded answer to your question is absolutely people are good to go once they've treated their CPAP, I mean their apnea.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that is it's a tremendous incentive, and I've had some of my patients do the same thing, and that is the glorious day when the sleep doctor, after having, you know, repeated the sleep test, says, oh my gosh, you know, pitch that machine, you're good. What a fantastic incentive to be able to do something like that. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, you know, the compliance issue. If people are out there are scratching their head saying, well, why aren't they compliant? Well, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're sleeping on your back. You can do some sleeping on your side, but it takes some finesse. It's kind of hard to adapt to that. You're going to sleep with something on your face, and it's hard.
Right.
It's difficult for some people to really adapt to, and they feel resentful about it, and it may feel uncomfortable, and they're struggling with it. So there's a lot of that going on. The good news is the newer machines are absolutely quiet. The old ones made so much noise that your partner, spouse, whatever, was, you know, sleeping in the next room in 5 minutes. And so technology has helped a lot. And those machines that you take with you are now much smaller and much more convenient to be able to do instead of schlepping around an entire suitcase full of, you know, tubing and heaven knows what else. Right? Make sense?
Absolutely. They make them now the size of a Coca-Cola can.
Yep, they do.
Can you believe
they
that?
They do.
It's
and I thank heavens that there's better technology around this. So if you're wondering if you have sleep apnea, if you have any questions whatsoever, ask your, you know, if you're with someone in your life, ask that partner, spouse, whomever, to check you out for snoring. You know, loud
exactly.
snoring and consistent snoring, and especially if you're waking up in the morning and feeling, you know, not great and like you've never gotten any sleep at all, well, it may be true, and it's time to undergo a sleep test with a sleep a specialist so that you can really document what's going on. And trust me, they're really accurate. And they'll be able to find what we call the apneic or no oxygen, no breathing episodes. And as Dr. Bruce said so well, could be hundreds just in an hour. So it's really great to know. And the sooner you get diagnosed, the better, you know, is really the bottom line. All right.
Absolutely.
So Dr. Bruce.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to let all of our audience members know they now also have home-based sleep testing. So if anybody out there I don't want to go into a laboratory or, oh dear, I don't want to head over to a hospital to have this done. there are many, many laboratories in every major city I can think of where they have home-based sleep testing, where they actually send a kit to your home, and you put it on, and then you send it back, and it's all done through the computer. So it's pretty amazing.
You know, it's interesting. After having seen the old-fashioned, you have to schlep yourself into the hospital or some kind of outpatient
right.
thing where you sleep overnight and whatever, I just kept saying to myself, you know, with all the technology we have now, why the heck can't we be doing this at home? Didn't make any
right.
sense to me, right? But now I'm
right.
really happy, and I'm so happy you brought that up, that there's now home-based sleep testing. So if you have any question whatsoever about whether or not there's an issue, well, here it is. Because it really is a pain in the drain to have to, you know,
mm-hmm.
pack up and go into a strange place and try to feel like you're home and going to sleep, like, really? Especially when you're all, you know, plugged into everything and back and forth. You know, Dr. Bruce, once again, just nothing but a fount of sleepy knowledge. As we close the podcast, you know, toss out some more, you know, closing wisdom as people are really having sat down and they're digesting a lot of what you said and really mm-hmm. thinking about their lifestyle and how they
right.
can reshuffle things to be able to optimize sleep. How about a word of wisdom before we close?
Absolutely.
Something to help them. Yeah.
Can I give them a few things to help? Is that okay?
I think a few things would be awesome.
Okay, so everybody can do these five steps that I'm going to tell you, and I promise you it will begin to improve your sleep. Step number one is find one sleep schedule and stick to it. That means waking up at the same time every day, including the weekends. Remember, we talked about that baseball game. That's going to be critically important. If you want to figure out what your chronotype is, if you go to my quiz, thepowerofwhenquiz.com, that'll help teach you when do you get up and when do you go to sleep. So step number one is one schedule. Step number two is to stop caffeine by 2 p.m. Most people don't know it, but caffeine has a half-life of between 6 and 8 hours. We don't want that affecting our sleep at night, so please stop by 2 p.m. Step number three has to do with alcohol. I don't have any problem with you having a drink, you know, a glass of wine or spirit with dinner, but you need to be careful. You don't want to go over 2 because that will start to really have an effect on your sleep. In addition, you want to stop drinking all alcohol approximately 3 hours before bed. That way it doesn't have an effect on your sleep. Remember, while alcohol may make you sleepy, it keeps you out of the deep stages of sleep, which is part of the reason you have a hangover. Step number four is exercise daily. 20 minutes every day is one of the best ways that you can actually improve your sleep quality. And step number five is when you wake up in the morning, within 30 minutes, go outside, breathe some fresh air, and get some sunlight for about 10 or 15 minutes. That helps reset your circadian clock, and you are good to go.
I am loving it, man. I was just writing all that stuff down furiously. I know it's all in your book, The Power of When. Just run over to Amazon and get this. I don't care what you do, Audible, Kindle, whatever. Just get it, because what we've been talking about is all in there, chock full of information. And it's really important right now to find out what you are, how you may be in some kind of transition, especially as you're aging, and how, you know, the simple, accessible, practical things you can do, as Dr. Bruce just said, to be able to fine-tune and perhaps reset what's been going on. Because, hey, for all of you out there doing that 24/7 thing, it's ugly, isn't it? How's that working for you? Not so well. It's time to buy The Power of When. Speaking of which, if you want to learn more about Dr. Bruce's wonderful work, please go to his website, thesleepdoctor.com. And if you want to learn more about the book, thepowerofwhen.com, because it's got the quizzes and all the rest of the great information that Dr. Bruce has been able to share with us. Well, Dr. Michael Bruce, thank you so much for being on the HER podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And everyone out there, remember to catch every episode of HER. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And just take a second now, right now, and rate and review this podcast on iTunes, because I'm a-waiting to hear from you. I read it all. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD, and you can also check out our Her Show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening, and stay well.